this year's Nobel in Economics for creating markets where there were none. We've got one of this year's winners. From APM, this is the Marketplace Midday Update podcast. I'm Jeff Horwich, and it's October 15th, 2012, as if you need to hear the year, right? We'll also talk about Sprint's future as a Japanese company, why Microsoft is offering you an incredible deal on its new streaming music service, and we've got a great piece on what it's like to try to get by as a U.S. citizen without a photo ID.
This podcast is supported by American Express Bank FSB, offering high-yield savings accounts designed with convenient features to help reach savings goals. To learn more or open an account online, visit personalsavings.com/savings. Member FDIC.
This year's Nobel Memorial Prize in Economics goes to Americans Alvin Roth and Lloyd Shapley. Roth is now at Stanford. He did a lot of his critical work while he was at Harvard and the University of Pittsburgh. Shapley is a professor emeritus at UCLA. The Nobel Committee honored them today for their work in, quote, the theory of stable allocations and the practice of market design. Sounds a little obscure, but it actually turns out to be pretty practical. And winner Alvin Roth is with me now on the line. Congratulations, first of all. And did you see this coming?
Thank you. I certainly didn't see it coming in the near term, but it was unexpected but not unimaginable.
Give me, if you could, sort of your elevator speech on what you were honored for here. Market design, what is that?
Well, market design is trying to understand how marketplaces work well enough so that we can fix them when they're broken. And my colleagues and I particularly study matching markets, which are the kinds of markets in which you can't just choose what you want, but you also have to be chosen. So like getting into college, you know, college admissions, the colleges can't choose who comes, they have to compete with other colleges, and the students can't choose where to go, they have to be admitted, they have to apply and be admitted and recruited. And getting a job, you can't just decide you want to work for Google, you have to be hired, and they can't just decide who they want to employ, they have to compete with Facebook and Stanford University. Mm-hmm. So lots of the most important markets that we are involved in our lives are these two-sided markets where you can't just choose what you want, but also have to be chosen.
From speaking with many economists, I know that many of them fret over the application of what they're working on in the real world. Have you been relatively satisfied that you've been able to make a difference in real things?
Well, I'm glad we can make a difference. It's hard to be satisfied when there's still so much to be done. But yes, it's very gratifying to help design marketplaces that get implemented and that help people go about their lives.
Is there any particular example that you're most proud of in that respect?
Well, my colleagues and I have helped design labor market clearinghouses, and we've helped design school choice systems, and we've helped design kidney exchange. I guess those three are the big areas that my work has, you know, been applied to in recent years.
The Nobel Committee honors people who have not just done interesting things, but have fundamentally changed the field. Have you felt all along that you were fundamentally changing the field?
You know, you feel all along that you're struggling to make changes in the field, and it's nice that someone thinks that we've succeeded.
Professor Alvin Roth, who along with Lloyd Shapley at UCLA won this year's Nobel Memorial Prize in Economics, thanks very much.
Thank you.
So there's a little bit on market design. Let's check the markets. Well, markets are up in the first few hours of trading. The Dow and the S&P 500 both up a couple hours in now, about 0.4%. The NASDAQ up a little bit less. U.S. retail sales rose 1.1% last month. We were spending more on cars, gas, and iPhones. Sales of the iPhone 5 helped to juice spending in the electronics category, which grew 4.5%. Well, Citigroup shares are way up in early trading after the bank reported much smaller third quarter profits, but still beat Wall Street expectations. Paradoxically, maybe investors perhaps celebrating the reason for those smaller profits. Citi took a big fat write down this quarter for selling off its share of a brokerage that is struggling, Morgan Stanley Smith Barney. Investors were evidently looking for more out of Gannett. Gannett's share price is down, even though the company earnings report seemed to be bearing mostly good news. Gannett is the country's largest newspaper chain, also owns a bunch of TV stations. It's kind of a tough industry to be in these days, but TV ad revenue for Gannett got a boost from the Olympics and the election. More interestingly, to me anyway, Gannett says subscription revenue for newspapers was up, thanks largely to folks paying up for online access. Well, Japan's third largest wireless company, SoftBank, has reached a deal to buy Sprint Nextel here in the U.S. If regulators and shareholders approve, the $20 billion deal would be the largest ever Japanese acquisition of a foreign company. Here's Marketplace's Amy Scott.
Sprint is the number three mobile carrier here in the U.S. Verizon and AT&T each have roughly twice as many customers. One reason? They've been a lot quicker to build their high-speed 4G networks.
That's what customers want. They want the speed.
That's analyst Jeff Kagan. Sprint is in the middle of its own $7 billion network upgrade. Kagan says the deal with SoftBank would give the company much-needed cash to move faster on its conversion to 4G.
Sprint, while they're moving into 4G, they're just moving into it at a glacial pace. And this is going to help them immensely.
Will faster service mean higher prices? Kagan says probably not. When you're in third place, you've got to offer something the competition doesn't. Shareholders and regulators will have to approve the deal with SoftBank. It's the third largest mobile phone carrier in Japan. Kagan says the approval process will take longer with a foreign company involved. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Brick-and-mortar chains are hauling out some new tricks this year to try to get you to actually buy in the store. Best Buy, for example, said the other day it'll match prices of online retailers like Amazon during the holiday shopping season. Can anything make us shop the way we used to? Here's reporter Sally Herships.
The retailer strikes back against showrooming. That's when customers browse in the store but buy online from someone else. Best Buy hopes its new policy will keep shoppers in its own checkout line. Pradeep Chintagunta teaches marketing at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business.
It's very critical for a retailer to have the customer actually walk into the store. They could then come across other products in the store that they end up buying.
Which is why JCPenney sent out a $10 coupon and Neiman Marcus and Target are offering an exclusive line of products. They're both ways to get customers not just into, but shopping at their stores. But not that these retailers think all e-commerce is bad. Retail historian Harvard professor Nancy Kane says the future of marketing will be blended like a martini.
Right, where the vodka is the e-commerce and the vermouth is the brick-and-mortar commerce.
If you don't buy at a Best Buy store, the brand would still like you as a customer. Online. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by American Express Bank, FSB, offering high-yield savings accounts with a competitive variable interest rate and convenient access via phone or web. Link your existing bank accounts without switching banks. To learn how this FDIC-insured high-yield savings account can complement your savings goals and to open an account online, visit personalsavings.com/savings. Member FDIC.
The release of Windows 8 is just, 11 days away now? Well, it turns out Microsoft had another trick up its sleeve. The company today announced a new music service that it's calling Xbox Music. Despite the name, it'll be available across various Windows devices. You can basically listen to whatever you want, a la carte, and it'll be free if you don't mind the occasional ad. James McQuivy is an analyst with Forrester Research. Good to talk with you.
Well, thank you for having me.
So the main thing I notice about this is it is supposed to be free. All you can stream for free. How is that going to work?
Well, it's a very important lure. Think of it as Microsoft going fishing for consumers. That music turns out to be a very fundamental part of our digital lives on all the devices that we use, the PCs, the mobile devices, tablets, and so on. And Microsoft hasn't fared very well outside of the PC and the Xbox, and it wants to bridge the gap between those things. It wants to add mobile. And the way to do that is to give us fish in the sea a very juicy lure.
But how is it really going to be free? I mean, you're listening to ads or something like that, right?
Yeah, well, in the long run, there will be more ways for Microsoft to monetize. But right now, they're writing this off as a marketing expense. This is a way for them to get you enmeshed in their entire, that word, ecosystem again, what we would maybe call a platform that they want you to connect to the Xbox environment, the PC environment, and hopefully more tablet and phones in the future. And if they can get you to go into those environments and eventually buy music and rent TV shows and get games, that you will be in a great position to generate revenue for them, just not through the music directly.
The way you're talking about getting into their ecosystem sounds a lot like Apple.
Yes, in fact, this is a response to Apple. Apple has owned the music business. Amazon has tried to make a good play for it. Microsoft, I don't think, has ambitions to replace Apple. They just want to say, oh, we can do that too, and then meanwhile, here's all the other things that we can do for you. That's going to be crucial for Microsoft in this next shift, because it's not where they've been in the past.
James McQuivey at Forrester Research, thanks.
Thank you.
This election day, 11 states will require voters to show a photo ID at the polls. That could complicate things for some 13 million American citizens. That's how many people, according to a survey from the Brennan Center for Justice, do not have access to a passport or a birth certificate. So what's it like living without a photo ID? Marketplace's Jeff Tyler takes a look.
Here you go, baby. In Philadelphia, 63-year-old Anna Gonzalez goes out of her way to visit Smith's Pharmacy, where the employees all know her by name.
Hello, Anna. How are you?
Hi, Mama. How you doing?
Gonzalez tried another pharmacy closer to home, but it required a photo ID to buy medicine. At Smith's, she gets her prescription with no hassle.
The reason I didn't have to show ID is because they already have my record and they know who I am.
If they didn't, she'd be stuck. Gonzalez doesn't have a photo ID. It's not that she can't afford it or doesn't want one. Gonzalez was born in Puerto Rico. Her parents gave her up for adoption, but it was all done informally. She doesn't even know the name of her biological mom and dad. That makes it virtually impossible for her to get a birth certificate.
I need a photo ID in order to get the birth certificate, and I need my birth certificate in order to get a photo ID.
She's in a complete catch-22.
Nikki Lute runs the face-to-face legal clinic in Philadelphia. She says about 40% of her cases involve helping people obtain legal identification.
I have clients who were either born at home and no formal record of their birth was ever made, or in some cases, the hospital they were born at had suffered a fire, or their record was just simply lost.
Without a photo ID, you can't open a bank account. Most job applications require proof of identification, and Lute says forget about trying to collect benefits.
Somebody couldn't obtain food stamps or cash assistance if they were raising minor children, or medical assistance or Social Security benefits without proof of ID.
As it stands, if Anna Gonzalez's husband were to die, she would be cut off from his retirement benefits.
I wouldn't be able to receive his pensions. He's got two pensions, plus also the Social Security.
Gonzalez says her husband would like to retire, but he's holding off until he can get his wife's name added to his pension. The holdup, as you might have guessed, the employer wants her photo ID. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Quick bit of technology news here, just in time for Halloween, I guess, maybe. Researchers in France are testing a natural alternative to fiber optic cable, spider silk. It is super thin, super lightweight, super tough, and it transmits light-based data almost as well as glass. Apparently, what's more, spider silk is perfectly tolerated inside the human body, which could mean advances in implantable medical devices. And finally, that skydive from space that we've heard so much about wasn't the only Guinness World Record broken in recent days. From the International Bartenders Association comes news of the world's most expensive cocktail. Its creator is a internationally renowned cognac expert, Salvatore Calabrese, and he gave the drink the modest name Salvatore's Legacy. It contains a cognac from 1788, an orange curacao from 1860, two dashes of century-old Angostura bitters. Salvatore does the math for us and says there are 730 years collectively in that drink. So if you find yourself at London's Playboy Club with a little extra cash on hand, that's where this thing is served. The cost of a glass of Salvatore's Legacy is $8,800. Drink up. That's it for today's Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Jeff Horwich, and this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.